Harmony.
Yep. Okay.
This morning we're going to have an overview from the Minnesota Department of Health. And we're going to hear from the commissioner, and we'll have some information about the budget as has been released from the governor for this committee, for the department that this committee has oversight with. We also are going to spend a little extra time today on one of the divisions that is in this agency, and that's the Environmental Health Division. Because of the information that came out of the Health Department late Friday that had to do with the levels of PFBA found in wells in southeastern metropolitan area, we've had a lot of inquiries. I've had a lot of inquiries, and I've invited the legislators who represent that area to come sit with us at the table. So Representative Giribon, I see, is here with us. I know Representative McNamara probably will be here. He's on the committee. Representative Carl Bingham will be coming, and Senator Katie Sleeman. We want to be responsive as a committee to the questions as they come up as timely as we can, because there's an awful lot of concern out there in the community. So we may spend a little more time on that than we had originally planned. But we'll get to the whole Health Department's budget and overview today and tomorrow. We've set aside two whole times. We really want to make sure we give this agency the opportunity it needs and deserves to work with us. So, Commissioner, I believe you wanted to start. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I am Commissioner Diane Mandanat, and I'm very pleased to be here today to present an overview of the Minnesota Department of Health budget. In a moment, I'm going to turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Margaret Kelly, who will explain where our funding comes from and where it goes. As she goes through the budget, you're going to notice that the vast majority of our funding comes from the federal government, primarily the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which houses the CDC. You're also going to notice that much of our funding passes through us to local public health agencies and a host of other grantees that work with us on a wide range of public health issues. Before Margaret starts her overview, I just want to say a few words about our mission and our work to provide the context for the budget discussion. The Minnesota Department of Health's mission is to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans. The department operates programs in the areas of disease prevention and control, health promotion, family and community health, environmental health, healthcare policy, emergency planning and preparedness, and quality assurance for healthcare providers and facilities. We are responsible for carrying out a wide range of activities that are designed to protect and improve the public's health. We investigate disease outbreaks and work to detect and prevent the spread of infectious disease. We protect the quality of food that we eat in our restaurants, the safety of our public water supplies, and the air inside our public buildings. We prepare for natural or man-made emergencies ranging from flood to bioterrorism to pandemic flu. We coordinate the planning and implementation of statewide initiatives that are designed to prevent and reduce the burden of chronic disease. We identify and evaluate potential health hazards in the environment, from simple sanitation problems to the health risks associated with toxic waste sites. We provide sophisticated laboratory services, including techniques and procedures for screening biological and chemical samples that are available nowhere else in the state. We work to help people lower their health risks by giving them information and support for making healthy choices. We safeguard the quality of our state's health care. We regulate many of the people and institutions that are responsible for providing that care. We develop and implement strategies to contain health care costs while broadening access to affordable and high-quality health care for all Minnesotans. Improving health is not just MDH's job. It requires coordinated efforts on the parts of all levels of government, the private sector, community groups, and yes, the individual themselves. I'm sure you're aware of the fact that Minnesota consistently ranks as the healthiest state in the nation. And one of the key reasons that we rank so high is because of the state's strong support for public health. I want to really express my appreciation to the legislature for the past financial support of public health in Minnesota. And I look forward to continuing to make the case to you and with you for your ongoing support as we move forward so we can continue to have a strong public health system and excellent medical care. With that as a context for our budget, I want to turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Margaret Kelly, who is going to walk you through the detail of our budget. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, you should have two things in front of you. One is an organizational chart that shows how the department has organized itself. And we are going to be talking today in the blue column, our Health Protection Bureau. The second thing you should have is Minnesota Department of Health fiscal year 2008-2009 base budget overview. And these are the documents that we'll be walking through today and tomorrow. We were asked to provide an overview of our base budget, so this reflects our budget before any changes are made, recommendations from the governor. So it's the starting point, and if you need additional information, we can plan to do that as well. I want to turn to the first page, which is a pie chart that shows what our funding sources are. I just want to give you a flavor of the complexity of the funding we have here at the Department of Health. We have seven, I believe, distinct funding sources for the work that we do. All of our funding sources are interdependent. General fund resources leverage federal dollars. Federal dollars require state participation, maintenance of effort, or match. And our fee revenues free up the general fund to do other activities. Only 16% of our budget is funded by the general fund, which is the main source of revenues for the state. 46% of our budget is federal funds. These funds contribute to a majority of the public health activities that take place here in the state, but at the same time, they also set priorities, and so we implement federal priorities and not necessarily state priorities with the federal dollars. We try to do as much as we can with state priorities. Federal funds are both categorical, meaning they're for specific programmatic activities. They're also discretionary, meaning that we can use them in any way, but the majority of federal dollars are categorical, meaning that we have no discretion as to how to spend them. Third funding source is Medical Education and Research Costs Fund. This is a fund that consists of a mixture of federal dollars, state dedicated cigarette tax dollars, and funds that are general fund dollars that come from the University of Minnesota. The fourth category is the State Government Special Revenue Fund, which is non-dedicated fee revenues. For all of our regulatory compliance licensure activities, we assess fees to the stakeholders, to those being licensed or being certified or being certified or inspected. And these fees are set at a level to recover our costs. And statute requires that we set it at a level that does not over-recover or under-recover. And so the activities that are funded with fee revenues are self-supporting activities, funded 100% with fee revenues. The next funding category is the Healthcare Access Fund, which is provider and premium tax revenues. It traditionally has been used to improve healthcare access around the state, and the major expenditure out of this fund is the Minnesota Care Program. We do have a small piece of funding for activities at the Health Department as well. The final category is the Miscellaneous Special Revenue Fund, which reflects interagency agreements and contracts between agencies, between divisions within the department, and contracts with non-state entities. If you turn to page 3, you can see how we allocate our funding among all of our divisions at the Department of Health. The majority of our funding is in the... You're missing a page 2, it looks like. Are you missing a page 2?
Yes.
Well, my apologies. We'll get that information to you. Page 2 shows a pie chart that explains how our grant dollars are used, how our dollars are used, that two-thirds of our funding goes out the door in grants, and only one-third of our funding stays at the Department of Health for MDH-based activities. The graph on page 3 shows how our funding is allocated among programs within the department, among divisions. And the Community Family Health Division has the most funding primarily because of our WIC funding, a federal funded program, Women, Infants, and Children, which is a very large grants program. We today are going to focus on environmental health, infectious disease, epidemiology, prevention and control, the public health lab, and the Office of Emergency Preparedness. You are probably also missing page 4, which is a pie chart that shows you the funding for the Environmental Health Division. And I think I'll ask John Stein, the director of our Environmental Health Division, to come on up here. We can proceed in one of two ways, Madam Chair. We could give you an overview of how this division is funded and how what the activities are in this division, or we could simply make ourselves available to questions at this time for...
Okay, this is on the environmental health?
Right, it is on page 5. You just simply don't have a pie chart that shows where the resources for this division comes from. This division is primarily funded with fee revenues and a little bit of general fund and a lot of federal funds as well.
Well, maybe since, as I mentioned, we have a special situation here today where we did want to spend a little time on the environmental health division. Why don't you go ahead and give us the overview, sign, and then we will have some discussion about the issue that came up on Friday, and then go back on with the rest of them.
That sounds great. I think I'll have John Stein, the division director, walk through page 5, which shows area by area within environmental health what we do.
Okay, one moment, please. Representative Madar.
Madam Chair, I'm noticing that we're missing every other page.
I should get to
can we at least get an overview from the monitors here? Can it be? If you have the pages, can you perhaps see that?
That would be helpful.
We can do that.
Yeah. It looks like it was a copying problem, so we'll take care of that and make sure everybody gets at their office the full...
Thank you.
...the full document. There we go. That'll help. Mr. Stein, welcome to the committee. Why don't you introduce yourself, please?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is John Lankstein. I am the Division Director for Environmental Health at the Minnesota Department of Health. Prior to being at the Department of Health, where I began my employment about 2 years ago, I was employed by the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources in water management and trails and waterways management. So for those of you who are wondering where have I seen this guy's name before, it's probably from those places. What I've shown on the overhead that you can see on the screen is the page you're missing. And so what that shows on the left-hand side of the page is the funding sources as Margaret Kelly indicated. Approximately two-thirds of our revenue is from fees that we gain through our programs. About 25% are from federal funds, which come from the Environmental Protection Agency and the Centers for Disease Control. And then about 8% of our activity is general fund and 3% of other funds. Those are funds that are transferred from other agencies. Our expenditures are 98% on our activities, only 2% on our grants. Our activities then, if you go to the next page where we outline the detail items for our budget, which Margaret has just... You probably have a copy of that one, I'm trusting.
We do have page 5.
Okay, good. I'll quickly overview these activities. Our division mission is to address environmental hazards that could cause an impact to human health. Those fall into some major categories, and I'll address them one by one. But the bulk of our work is informing people, informing the public, providing information and technical services. We also investigate, we license, we certify compliance, and we certify the credentials of contractors and individuals working in environmental health professions. And then we inspect and enforce our rules relative to each of these program areas. So in some way or another, some of those activities occur in almost all of our programs. Drinking water, The state is the primacy agency designated by the Environmental Protection Agency for compliance with the Safe Drinking Water Act in Minnesota. There are approximately 8,000 drinking water systems that break down into about 1,000 community water systems. Those are water systems that are managed by Minnesota local units of government. We also then have about 7,000 what are called non-community water systems. Those are large water suppliers, businesses, churches, schools, any large source of water and distribution of water where people might be drinking for work, for community activities, for school, etc. We certify and inspect those systems on a schedule that's consistent with the risk of any contamination that might occur. There is a very long list. I don't even have committed to memory the number of contaminants that we're required to test for, but our staff collects samples. We analyze the samples using our public health laboratory at the Minnesota Department of Health, and then we report results back to the communities so they can inform their residents of the quality of the water that they're drinking. We have approximately 96% compliance rate for all contaminants across the state. That means that of all systems, all 8,000 systems, 96% of them are 100% compliant with all the required contaminant level readings. The next line I'll deal with is our well management program. That is the construction of private water wells and other water wells and borings. You might say, well, what would be an example of a boring that's regulated by the state? When you put in a vertical heat loop system, you'll see in heating and ventilation air conditioning contractors are using groundwater heat pump systems now with a vertical loop. It's basically a coil that's inserted down a vertical hole. Those holes are regulated by the state as well as water wells because those holes can become conduits for contamination of public water sources. We regulate the construction of wells. We also regulate the abandonment of wells. We do that through licensing 600 licensed contractors in the state. We inspect about 25% of their activities every year, and we have a 97% compliance rate with the Minnesota well contractors. The next program I'll discuss is one other thing I wanted to say about water wells. About 12,000 wells or borings are constructed every year in this state. We're down this year because of the downturn in the housing market. So when fewer homes are being built, fewer wells are being drilled. There are annually about 10,000 wells that are sealed. That's a process of when you transact a sale of a home, you need to report any unused or abandoned wells on your property, and then if those wells are unused and remain in that fashion, then they need to be abandoned by a licensed well contractor. That means sealed up with concrete. They pump concrete into the well to completely close the hole so that it can no longer be a conduit for contamination of groundwater systems. Food safety and hospitality services. This is a program in which we inspect and license food handling operations in restaurants, hotels, and we also inspect and certify compliance for public swimming pools in communities and in lodging facilities around the state. Primary clientele here are restaurant operators, hotel and lodging resorts, bed and breakfast facilities. Those are our clientele in this program area. And we have about 20,000 licensed facilities in Minnesota that we're responsible for inspecting and evaluating. We have an additional partnership role here with local units of government that operate programs under our delegated program authority. About 45 communities in the state are delegated to implement this program. When they do that, they charge the fees, they collect the fees, they operate the program off of their fees. Indoor environments and radiation control is the next section I'll address. This is the section in which we address some of the traditional indoor air and indoor environment hazards that occur in our state. The indoor air program area includes compliance with the Clean Indoor Air Act. The informational activities we conduct around radon, which is a radioactive gas that comes through the soil, gets into the basement of homes. Minnesota is one of the highest incidents of radon in homes of all states in the country. We have a very successful program of informing the public, trying to get them to test for radon in their home to see if it's a problem, and then working with contractors who can help them remediate that problem if it is present. The Lead Hazard Grant Program is a grant that we passed through and was formerly housed in the Department of Education. Our lead-based grant is a grant that we provide to a housing entity who provides temporary housing for families that need to relocate because of lead hazards in their home. And that gets me to the Lead Abatement Program, which is a largely federally funded program, which assures that we have an efficient response system if a child who is tested is found to have high blood levels of lead. About 80,000 children are tested annually. Last year, there were 1,300 cases of elevated blood levels across the state. Majority of those occur in urban areas where lead-based paints were used in homes. And as those paints are deteriorated through time and wear, they form dust, and kids playing in the dust and the dirt get that into their systems. If an elevated blood level occurs, we're required to intervene quickly and to take action to clean up the home. Those cases where people are relocated, the grant program, that lead-based grant program, assists them with temporary housing needs during the period of that cleanup. Radiation control. We certify, license, and register all X-ray equipment in the state. Those occur in doctor's offices, clinics, hospitals, veterinary clinics, dental offices, and chiropractor offices. There are 4,400 registered X-ray machines in this state. We're required to inspect them on a four-year basis. We also license 170 handlers of radioactive materials. Those are sources of radioactive materials that are used in research or in medical treatment, such as chemotherapy or radiation therapy for cancer. We have recently, in the last year, in April of this past year, become an agreement state with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which means that we now are implementing the federal regulations for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in this state. And that's been a successful endeavor to work with the licensed handlers of radioactive materials. The next line is actually a separate program area, but it's characterized incorrectly on this page. It's our environmental impacts and risk assessment line. It should actually be a bold line and have a line above it. I apologize, we didn't get that correction made. But that is the program in which we evaluate environmental impacts on sites. We also use federal funds to achieve some of these purposes, grant through the Centers for Disease Control. We evaluate risks that occur in communities around the state as contaminants are found in soil, water, and air. We advise other state agencies through this program, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's program for pesticide and fertilizer control, as well as the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's regulations for any pollution control activities or regulation that they conduct. This is the area in which, Madam Chair, we're conducting the majority of our activity related to the perfluorochemicals investigation in Washington County. And these are the folks that basically work on those subjects. We do work in this program area to identify levels of risk that are quantifiable, certain number of parts per billion of a given constituent in water or in soil or in air that pose a threat. And we have toxicologists. This is a group of people largely with PhDs and are far more well-educated than I in that subject, and we're very fortunate in this state to have some very highly qualified individuals. The last line I'll talk about is our director's office, which is my office and my staff of myself and some support dollars there. With that, I'll just give a couple other comments. We employ 275 people. We have staff both in the St. Paul Freeman office building as well as the seven district offices around the state. The folks that are out in our district offices are largely our drinking water inspectors, our food, beverage, and lodging, or our environmental health services staff that are doing inspections and investigations, as well as our well management staff. With that, Madam Chair, I'll answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Stein. I just want to remind committee members, some of you came a little bit late. We are going to take a little time today to talk about the Environmental Health Division because of the concern that has been raised by the press release that came out on Friday afternoon about the levels of PFBA found in six city wells. Lots of questions came to me, and so I'm really happy that the Health Department just happens to be here today, and we can spend a little time on that. And I will note again that we did invite several of the legislators who represent that area, in addition to Representative McNamara, who I believe is on our committee, and he represents a part of that community, of that area, Cottage Grove and Hastings. And we also have joined us at the table here, Representative Carla Bingham. And your area is which?
The other half, Madam Chair, the other half of Representative McNamara's district, which is Cottage Grove, I have half of it, and then I actually have St. Paul Park, Newport, South St. Paul, Great Cloud Island Township.
And Representative Julie Bond, you represent?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I actually represent just the northeast corner of Woodbury and the north from there. In terms of the maps I've seen in the information release so far, this particular recent finding is not directly affecting my legislative district, but I have a previous history with this in that we have two disposal sites, one in Oakdale and one in Lake Elmo, that have contained 3M waste, and that have been previously determined to have seven different chemicals, some of the cousins of the one that's been found more recently in our communities, affecting most of the entire western half of Lake Elmo, and now moving southward towards Woodbury. So I have some previous experience with this issue in those areas.
And I believe, pardon me, Representative Wills, I think you have a part of it.
Yes, I have the city of Woodbury, and it's so interesting to look at the map on this sheet of paper where it says outline dashed where extent unknown. My house is in that little area, so I'm I have a personal stake in this discussion.
And she is pointing to a packet that you all should have in your at your site today. And then we're very honored to have the state senator from that area today, Senator Katie Sieben, and you want to just tell us parts of the area here that you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's nice to be back in the House, I must say. I represent District 57, which is the areas that Representative McNamara and Representative Bingham represent.
So our purpose today is to have a chance for a good public airing of some of the questions that have at least come to me as the chair of this committee about the issues of the contamination of PFBAs. And I don't know if you have any of your toxicologists here, but I would guess that some of the questions might have to do with some of those issues. And for members who may not be so familiar with what we're talking about, you should have in your packet, or in your you have a packet that has the map and the press release. And I'm just wondering, as we get started, Mr. Stein, I believe you were in charge of this press release, or I know your office called me.
Yes.
Do you want to just quickly run through what this press release was doing in lunch? Maybe also I'd kind of like to know the process that you went through to come to the conclusions that you have in this press release. And I would just like to ask the committee members, particularly those who represent those areas, to have, share any questions they may have.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate this opportunity to quickly be able to talk to so many legislators about this information. I also have spare copies here at the desk. If there are people in the audience who have not seen the information, we can certainly make that available to members of the audience as well. The reason for the press release was we were working in Lake Elmo and Oakdale over the past 3 years, as Representative Bunn noted. We were progressing south with our investigation to follow the natural flow of groundwater, which in Washington County is from north to south. We were looking for the leading edge of the plume of contaminants that were found in Oakdale and Lake Elmo, and we were working in cooperation with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to do that work. As we proceeded into Woodbury, we found that levels of the compounds of greatest concern, PFOA and PFOS, were non-detect. In other words, they were not present in the Woodbury well system as we were working our way south, but we were continuing to find ever-decreasing levels of PFBA, the perfluorobutanoic acid, which is the subject of the discussion in Cottage Grove. So what we were thinking at the time, and this would have been in the fall of this past year, was that we were kind of coming to the close of an investigation, that we had found nearly the leading edge of the plume. We weren't seeing concentrations of any significant concern, and so we were ready to kind of wrap up our work. Then the City of Cottage Grove Municipal Water System folks asked if we could sample their wells and do tests for these compounds. Now, we routinely sample Cottage Grove's wells on a quarterly basis to confirm that their water meets all the Safe Drinking Water Act requirements. So these tests for perfluorochemicals are above and beyond those normal tests. We did the tests in November and December on water samples taken from Cottage Grove's wells. We found results, which are reported in our press release. Mm-hmm. And we did confirmatory. We always confirm a first sample result because one sample can be contaminated. You can have erroneous laboratory processes. So you always do a second sample to verify what you found with your first sample. The second round of sampling occurred during December and early January, and the results just came in the first couple of weeks of January. When those results were identified and confirmed, then we met with the City of Cottage Grove officials and started to talk about what this might mean, how we might be conducting a future investigation, and that's what really led up to the press release. Earlier last week, Madam Chair, we met with several of the community representatives and senators at the urging of Senator Katie Sieben, who was very interested in learning more about this, and it was a useful opportunity for us to inform them. Once we got later toward the end of the week, it was becoming clear that we needed to put out a press release to kind of inform the entire community of what we had found. We were getting media inquiries, and we wanted to be equitable in terms of getting the information out all at once. So that's what led to us generating the press release last Friday. With that, what I can say about this, about our investigation, is we have, as you can see by the map, we've taken samples in Cottage Grove, St. Paul Park, Newport, and Woodbury. We've had two rounds of sampling results in all of those communities, both confirming levels of PFBA. We've started sampling wells in South St. Paul and Hastings. In fact, yesterday we took our second round of samples of those community water systems. Again, the first round of samples found low levels of this compound. None of the other perfluoro compounds were found in those wells in South St. Paul or Hastings. So we're only dealing with a couple tenths part per billion, roughly, of PFBA in South St. Paul and Hastings. We're also expanding our investigation now to look at Invergrove Heights and Rosemount, as well as additional non-community wells in Cottage Grove, Great Cloud Township, Denmark Township, and the western part of Cottage Grove to determine what levels we might find in other wells in the area. So at this point, the investigation is still ongoing. And as I say in the press release, a couple of things that we know about this compound is that it's a different molecular structure from the PFOA and PFOS, which basically is to say it's a shorter carbon molecule. The PFOA and PFOS have 8 carbons with a bunch of attachments on them. The PFBA is a 4-carbon molecule and is an acid as well with butane in it. The risk associated with that compound is not yet well understood. There's only been recent investigations using laboratory animals. At the end of last year, we asked 3M if they would consider conducting laboratory studies. They did start those studies in September, and they've gotten their preliminary results back, and we're currently reviewing their preliminary results upon which to evaluate risk of this compound. One thing we do know about PFBA is it's There was a study that they conducted on mice to assess the residence time in the blood of these mice in these test populations as compared to PFOA and PFOS. And the residence time is much shorter. And when you try to translate that then into how it would behave in a human body, it's a significant difference in terms of the amount of time that it resides in a person's bloodstream. Studies that have been done by chemists and toxicologists researching PFOA and PFOS have really only been going on since the late 1990s, early part of this decade. Residence time in human blood is estimated to be somewhere between 2.5 years to 5.5 years for those compounds, PFOA and PFOS. The residence time based on this one study of laboratory animals, PFBA, is approximately 2 to 3 months worth of time in a human body, which means your body processes and eliminates the chemical in all likelihood much more efficiently than it does the other chemical compounds. That being said, we still do not understand any of the potential toxic effects, long-term toxic effects, of this compound because there are very little. There is only this one study that 3M conducted at the end of last year on laboratory animals on PFBA. 3M has informed us they expect to conduct additional laboratory studies this current year using a 90-day rodent study, which we're currently working with them on to evaluate the design and protocol of that methodology. So at this time, we have told the communities that we do not believe there's a significant cause for immediate action on the drinking water system. We are giving advice that if people are risk averse and they want to reduce their exposure to the risk of this chemical compound, being that it's uncertain as to its effects, there are some measures people can take to reduce their consumption of drinking water, supplementing other sources. And we're currently designing some tests, some laboratory tests, to evaluate the effectiveness of Brita and Pure home filtration systems to determine what they might actually remove from drinking water in these communities. So we're designing some laboratory tests this week to try to evaluate how effective those filtration methods will be at removing this compound from the drinking water in this part of the Washington County. We expect to meet with the community leaders this coming Thursday afternoon, and we've invited all the municipal officials to attend that meeting, and I would welcome any legislative members or staff that are interested. The meeting will be at 3:30 p.m. at the City of Cottage Grove City Hall. At that meeting, we expect to share additional information about what we're learning as we're gathering additional information about this investigation. We also will be planning a series of public information meetings with the community leaders to help explain the information we have to the community members as well as answer questions that folks have. So with that, Representative, I stand for questions.
Okay. Representative Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I missed the very beginning, so I didn't catch your name. So.
My name is John Stein.
Thanks, Mr. Stein. Mr. Stein, I'm looking at this news release here, and your testimony just now, you talked about different research that you're going to be doing to look at the efficacy of strategies to remove these contaminants. Yet it just strikes me as odd. I look at your press release, and it says, levels pose no immediate health risk to residents, as though this is the primary concern is to is of a public relations nature, and that's alarming to me. I think if our real strategy is to protect public health, and you're looking at ways to do that, I can't understand why that would be your lead on your press release. So maybe you could explain that a little bit to us.
Madam Chair, Representative Moll, absolutely. The immediate concern is what we do know about this family of chemical compounds is they are not acute in their effects on human beings. They do not result in immediate illness or toxic effects. What's been studied about this family of compounds suggests that their effect is very long-term in nature and accumulates over a period of a long span of time. So this isn't, when we say immediate concern, that's because it does not pose an immediate risk to people drinking. That being said, everyone has risk aversion. It's a personal decision what you're averse to in terms of personal risk. And so we give advice to people about other ways that they can mitigate the risk, taking measures into their own hands. If they want to reduce their consumption of that water source, if they want to look to alternative filtration. We do know that activated carbon treatment, which are some of the more expensive systems that can be installed, they're not the under-the-sink kind of activated carbon filtration systems. These would be more of the they're more like a supersized water conditioner, water softener, that can be installed in your home, are effective at removing all perfluorocarbons from your drinking water. So that's another action that people can take. But at this time, given the limited amount of information we know about toxicity on this compound, we do not feel it prudent to create alarm in the community by saying there's an immediate threat. There is not an immediate threat.
Stephen?
Thank you, Chairwoman Clark, and Mr. Stein, thank you for being here. I have so many questions. I'm going to try to boil it down to a couple to not take up too much of the committee's time, but I guess I'd like to start with the fact that the PFBA level was set at a level of one part per billion. And in your press release and in your meeting with me and other legislators, you said that the Department of Health set this level based on the health-based value for PFOA. And I'd like to ask you in this setting, why is it acceptable for the residents of Minnesota or the residents of our area to have a level of exposure set at one part per billion when the Environmental Protection Agency is setting levels lower than that, half as low as that, in fact, at 0.5 parts per billion in other parts of the country? And for members, just in doing some really preliminary background research on this, the EPA this past fall set a level of 0.5 parts per billion for PFOA in West Virginia and parts of Ohio. And so I'd like the Department of Health's explanation as to why you believe it's safer for residents of Minnesota to have a higher level of exposure to PFBA.
Madam Chair, Senator Stephen, just a point of clarification from my perspective, the level that was set by the EPA for the site in West Virginia and Ohio is related to a cleanup of a drinking water system in a community there. And their primary focus, it's a site-specific number. That's not a number that EPA has endorsed for use as a determinant for the drinking water standard. It's intended to achieve a cleanup result in the community's water system, and I think that's an important distinction. All that being said, when we reference the one part per billion level of advice that we give to communities, and we did use one part per billion in Lake Elmo when we found waters in Lake Elmo that contained this compound. At the time we did that, we had virtually no information on the specific nature of PFBA or how it interacts with systems of the body. Since that time, we have one study. We have a little bit more information that we're using to evaluate and reevaluate the relative toxicity. You asked, why is it safe? We're not saying yet. This is not a health-based value that we've set. This is an advisory level that we're using to provide community members with information about what we know about risk. In the absence of sufficient technical studies, we feel it's important to inform community members so that they can mitigate risk that's present from their perspective. We do not yet have a health-based value for this compound. When we used one part per billion as the surrogate value from PFOA, and you're right that it does appear to us that the health-based value for PFOA could be reevaluated, could be reassessed, and we're currently looking at that information, that if that's true, we would propose a lower health-based value in the future for those compounds. Relative to PFBA, we do not have sufficient amount of data at this time to set a health-based value.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chairwoman Clark. And Mr. Stein, I appreciate your explanation of that. In some regard, it doesn't mean I agree with it. I want to move on then to the assumption that it should be up to the people of Cottage Grove or the residents of South Washington County to make his own determinations for themselves. People are very frustrated. They don't understand what this means. And for to have the Department of Health come in and say these compounds are less toxic than other compounds is unacceptable. It's unacceptable to me and to the people that I represent. It's especially concerning for the exposure to infants and pregnant women. We know that the detrimental health effects that PFOA specifically has on developing fetuses. So for the Department of Health to come and say, well, you know, residents, if you caught this press release and you saw it on the news, you may want to take steps to drink bottled water. Do you understand my frustration? I mean, it's just, and I understand that not all the information is known, but it would seem to me, and it would seem that by following some of the statutory obligations we have for protecting the drinking water for infants and young children and developing fetuses, that the Department of Health could have at least said, for this category of people, bottled water is recommended. And because we know, and the Department of Health has said, that health-based values or advisory limits for these contaminants should be reduced by a factor of 3 to 4 for young children or infants. So I'm wondering, first of all, I'm urging you to talk about that in the meeting on Thursday with community members. And I guess I would hope and encourage you to, you and the department, to carefully examine the type of language that is used in trying to assure the public and not cause panic, but yet possibly, and this is unknown, but possibly endangering or harming the state's youngest residents or soon-to-be-born residents.
Madam Chair and Senator Stephen, I understand the frustration, and I am sympathetic to the concern of the community in trying to address this issue. I was a resident of Oakdale for 20 years. I raised my kids on the community water system that supplies water to the city of Oakdale. I am not unaware of the potential for there to be frustration, and certainly we do work to understand the risk to developing children and to pregnant women. That is a factor that we're considering in the reevaluation of the health-based values for PFOA and PFOS. One thing that I will also take to heart is your advice and your admonishment to consider alternative ways to characterize what community members can and should do to minimize their risk. I think that's a helpful way of thinking about it. We had also come up with some other ideas that we're currently discussing with our staff about how we might characterize advice differently. Right now we tended to use a one number seems to be suitable for all levels of the population. Perhaps there's a way that we can characterize mitigative measures for subpopulations, pregnant women and children. What we think an appropriate mitigative response might be in those groups of people. So I take that to heart, and I understand the concern. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Did you have your hand?
I
have a list thank here. I said everybody.
Thank you, Chairwoman Clark. I have 2 points of concern, and I'd like to talk about. First, you had mentioned that for the PFOA, and forgive me, I'm not a chemist, so for the PFOA in Lake Elmo and Oakdale, your health phase value was at 1 part per billion.
Madam Chair, Representative Bigham, in Lake Elmo, we were using 1 part per billion for PFOA, 0.6 parts per billion for PFOS.
Okay. And at what point, Chairwoman Clark, at what point did you put or advise the residents to go on to bottled water?
In Lake Elmo?
Just saying.
Yes.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Bigham, we use the 1 part per billion level in Lake Elmo. As I mentioned in response to Senator Stevens' question, that was at a time when we had virtually no information about relative toxicity. And my understanding today, just looking at numbers from the staff, the number of households in Lake Elmo that were put onto bottled water or activated carbon treatment are 50 or less as a result of the PFBA concern.
Okay.
In Lake Elmo and Oakdale, we were dealing with a higher number of contaminants in the groundwater system, so you had combinations of PFOA, PFOS, and PFBA.
Well, Chairwoman Clark, if you are using the 0.6 for health base value for PFOA or PFBA, I have the map here that was provided that virtually all of the wells are over that, and yet there's been no discussion about bottled water or a filtration system that you had just said would eliminate all of these contaminants. So I'm wondering, when can we expect that from 3M or from the Department of Health? And then I'll move on to my next point.
Representative Clark and Representative Bigham, just point of clarification. In Oakdale and Lake Elmo, we used 1 part per billion as the level for PFBA. So
yeah.
You had said something different. I just wanted to clarify that. We have not decided at this point to advise the community to go or the Pollution Control Agency to provide bottled water or to take any more intervening measures into the community's water system. We will continue to evaluate information to learn as much as we can about this chemical and its toxicity. As we moved through the investigation in Oakdale and Lake Elmo, there's a number of facets of information you need to evaluate in terms of understanding risk and toxicity. It took some time, and I know that that's not a sufficient answer to people that are concerned. We're trying to get a better answer about toxicity as quickly as we can.
But in the meantime, in the meantime, the residents deserve to have this covered. And you may be deliberating or whatever, but I'm asking you to do it. Just saying.
Madam Chair, Representative Bigham, I take your request into consideration and we'll give it due consideration, discuss it within our agency.
The last question I have is, and we emailed about this morning, about the testing of Great Cloud Island private wells, and you had replied that you have a plan to do that, and I would just like to reiterate that I would like that a priority for that area as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Bigham, duly noted, yes, we will be sampling wells in Great Cloud Township.
Thank you for your time, too, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stein, I just have a couple of questions. First of all, a comment, and that is that, many of the residents in Woodbury are related in some fashion to the 3M Corporation. It's been a great community partner and has taken a lot of positive steps in order to assure the safety of the public over the past. What I'm curious about, though, is if your recommendation is that we have an activating carbon filtration system. What is the means of providing a filtration system such as that that would protect the city water in our wells? Is it possible to have that installed into the city wells, or is that something, when you said people could have this installed into their homes, and it's the size of a water conditioner, and I'm thinking about the many people in our community who could not afford to have that kind of a system installed. Is this going to be those who can afford to keep themselves safe are the ones that will be protected versus those who can't afford it? I hate seeing it becoming an issue of those who have versus those who have not.
Madam Chair, Representative Swales, thank you. At this point, the advice is for those people who are risk-averse and seek to reduce their risk. That's our advice. We don't know yet whether or not it's going to be prudent or advisable to undertake a community-wide filtration system. Let me just answer your other question, though. It is technically feasible. The City of Oakdale wells are undergoing treatment for all perfluorinated compounds at this time. I'm not certain of the number of municipal wells that are treated there. It's 3 or 5. I cannot recall the exact number, but that was a system that was brought online this fall. It's technically feasible, and we are looking at the design and the construction of Cottage Grove and other community water systems in South Washington County to try to answer those sorts of questions. Can it be done? If it cannot be done, what are other alternatives might exist? Other alternatives may include going to a different source of groundwater, going to a deeper aquifer, for example. It may include smaller treatment systems rather than one large community treatment system, several dispersed community-based treatment systems. Those are all alternatives, but I want to be sure that we have a better characterization of risk and understanding of that risk before we make that recommendation to the communities.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Next, I believe Representative Mechner.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I really appreciate you scheduling the Department of Health. It's like you anticipated that thing. So I think it's terrific. And Director Stein, I want to thank you and your department for being forthright with me and calling me prior as soon as you knew things. I appreciate that. And I understand you did it with the other area representatives and Senator Sieben. I appreciate that. Our concerns are very much for our constituents and the issues before them. I've got a number of concerns, and I will say 3M has been a good corporate neighbor to many of us, and I think some of the things that happened in the 40s, 50s, and 60s as far as disposal and that today we would never ever think of doing, but back then that was okay to do. That being said, I'm just going to ask really a lot of questions real quick so we can move through them. You mentioned the filtration system in Oakdale and Lake Elmo. I want to confirm my understanding. 3M's plants in Cottage Grove, the Chemolite plant, is a very likely source for some of those chemical problems in Oakdale and Lake Elmo. Now we're dealing with an area geographically closer to the plant. Is there any reason for those of us representing that district to think that 3M wouldn't pay like they paid in Oakdale, I think in the neighborhood of Lake Elmo and Oakdale together, maybe $20 million, if we come to find out, rather than the constituents in our district carrying these costs, is it not true that 3M has carried the cost in Oakdale and Lake Elmo?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, you're correct that in Oakdale and Lake Elmo, 3M did contribute significantly to the construction of the treatment system in Oakdale and the new community water system that's delivering water to residents of Lake Elmo. They were significant community partners financially there. I cannot speak for 3M's interest or willingness to contribute to the solution in Cottage Grove because I'm not 3M, and they'd be happy to comment on that, I would expect. I do want to just quickly touch on 3M's role in this investigation because I think sometimes there are questions that people have about the relationship between a regulated entity and the regulator. There are numerous relationships at work in regulating the business of producing chemical compounds and disposing of wastes.
The Minnesota Department of Health is not in that business of regulating waste production. That's the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and we work very carefully with them. That being said, you're correct that there are sites within Washington County during the 40s and 50s and 60s that were used for dumping these waste products. That was prior to the regulatory systems that we currently have in place, but that's how they got there in the first place. 3M has been a scientific partner with our agency, though, in developing the lab testing methods, sampling protocols, and evaluation for these compounds. And we have utilized their expertise as well as the expertise of other laboratories, public and private laboratories, that do this work across the nation. There are only four labs in the country who can test for these compounds. Minnesota's Public Health Lab was the first lab to develop the test for PFBA. That laboratory procedure was just developed a year ago. It is with 3M's support and assistance that we're able to evaluate our methods effectively, and we do split samples with 3M. All the water samples that are collected on 3M's properties or in to analyze anything related to their activity, we split those samples between our lab and their lab. We have split samples of community water system wells and find agreeing results, a complete agreement between our lab outcome and their lab outcome. So I do want to comment that 3M's scientific support is very productive in helping us understand what we're finding. As I mentioned though earlier, I can't speak to their willingness to contribute financially.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. The reason I wanted to put it on the record, because I'm expecting if they spent that kind of money on Oakdale and Lake Elmo, they better be spending it in their own community. That's my point. I don't expect you to make that decision, but if they're in the audience or if they're not, they'll listen to the tape. I'm sure of that. And then another one I wanted to clarify, and some of these might not take quite as long an answer because I think a lot of them are important. I want to confirm that you are working with the federal EPA, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and the DNR to use all the resources that are at your disposal, and that you're not short on resources you need to get the necessary knowledge that we'll have to make informed decisions for our constituents. I don't want panic, but I want them to know what they need to know as soon as we can deliver that information to them. Are you short on resources, or are you lacking coordination with those organizations that I mentioned that you need to bring to our attention right now?
Madam Chair.
Representative Stein, and I think it's only fair for the committee to know we're talking to someone who works for an administration that has a budget before us, and whether or not that is increased or not, his own personal opinion may not be, he may not be free to share with us. I just want to be clear.
So
I guess if you're asking for the budget that's before us for this division, if they've asked for any increased revenue, that's one thing. And if you're asking, and I don't know the answer to that because I haven't looked yet, but and if you're asking whether or not the people within that department have requested additional resources, that's probably another answer. So just keep that in mind, and I feel free to answer in the way you feel comfortable, Mr. Stein. I just want to make sure we all understand what we're talking about here.
Madam Chair, I didn't want to put much on the spot as I probably did. I just want to confirm, if you're going to need more money in the future, I hope that you will become before this committee and all the different ones that are right to ask for additional funds. I just want to know if you're feeling strapped now that this committee needs to know, or that you're not working with these agencies in the proper way. I mean, our conversations over the phone have been very positive that you are working together, and I just wanted to confirm that on the tape, that you are working together, that you have the adequate resources that you feel you need to be addressing the immediate concerns that are before us.
Madam Chair, and Representative McNamara, yes, we are working in close communication with other state and federal agencies that are involved in this sort of activity. I can tell you that at EPA, there's very little ongoing research in the PFBA. They have no research ongoing into that compound. We have asked them to up their efforts in that regard. With regard to our own resources and our ability to conduct this activity, we have it within our current resources, we have available tools to do this job. That's a and our work now is to continue the investigation and to work with the communities to help address the risk. Another point I'll offer is I'm aware that we asked the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the administration to consider an increase out of the remediation fund, and that is included in the governor's budget request. There's approximately a $50,000 annual increase from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency from the remediation fund to support this kind of work. So we have with our base budget plus that increase that's requested, that's what the governor's request will include, and it is sufficient for us to meet our needs.
Thank you, Director. And real
just,
quick.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. I just want to ask one question, and I had mentioned this with the commissioner before we started the hearings at all for this committee. I did ask for the budgets back to 2003, so when you're looking at that, and I guess as we continue maybe tomorrow and ongoing, I would still like to know, and you can come in with the numbers for this Environmental Health Division, has this division experienced cuts that we are now replacing, or are we going forward? Or I do really need to know that back to the 203 budget level, and if you don't know off the top of your head, we can move right on, but I want to make sure that we don't leave that off.
Madam Chair, I don't have the information, but we will get it for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate you asking for that. Director Stein, another question I have, a couple of them are related. First of all, is there other cousins to the PFCs that were used in the production of Scotchgard from 3M besides the ones that you know of now? And are we working to develop tests if there are other cousins? And has 3M been forthright in talking with you? I'll refer to them as other cousins in the Scotchgard production that we may potentially in the future need to know about.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, yes, 3M has been forthright. There are 11 compounds in the family of perfluorochemicals that we currently know of. The three that appear to be the most have the greatest concern for toxicity are the ones that we're looking for, but clearly PFOA and PFOS are at the top of the list in terms of toxicity. There are some other compounds that we don't have any information for, but we are able to test for at this time. I'll get you more information on those, but at this point, 3M has expressed a willingness to continue to work with us and develop additional analytical methods or other research that may be helpful.
Madam Chair, and thank you for your patience. This will really be, I think, my last one. Director Stein, we have some private wells in East Hastings that I think need to be added to the list. We have a dump site, the municipal dump in Hastings, that we used for a number of years, was used by 3M for a long time, and I think it's real important. It's an area that's been studied for different chemicals previous, and so the Dakota County will be a lot of help for you in those records, both with shallow and deep wells. And then if I can just ask, your map shows an area in Dakota County of the hashed mark, and I'm just curious where that is in Dakota County. I can't tell. That doesn't look like it's the dump site I'm talking about, but I'm wondering where that is.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative McNamara. The hashed area is really the area that where the city wells are sampled. This map is what we currently know of what's in the groundwater. Once we learn through sampling of additional community wells and non-community wells and private wells that the concentration expands beyond that area, then this map will change. And that is, so to rely upon this dashed line at this point is just what we know today. As we gain more information, I think what we'll logically find is concentrations that vary, but they will exist in the groundwater area over the vast majority of southern Washington County, at least southwestern Washington County. I do not know yet what we'll find when we look in private wells in other areas of Dakota County, but that's what we're currently working with the Pollution Control Agency to assess.
Thank you. I'm just going to deviate from the list for just a moment. Senator Stephen has indicated she has to leave. Did you have a final?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to clarify for the record, Representative McNamara, that the Department of Health, while I appreciate the information that you've provided thus far,
I learned of this when I contacted Director Stein and asked for any additional updates on the PFOA and PFOS issue. So I just want to clarify that the reason that I found out about this was because I contacted the Department of Health to ask for an update. I also want to say that I've been frustrated and concerned with the lack of communication with other cities besides the city of Cottage Grove. For instance, the public works directors may have been notified that the Department of Health was testing for some sort of compound, but the city administrators or the mayors of Newport, St. Paul Park, certainly Grey Cloud Island, South St. Paul, to my knowledge and from what my conversations with them, did not know. The Department of Health did not contact them. They either learned from me or from news accounts or from the city administrator in Cottage Grove. So I just want to make the point here that there needs to be better communication about this. I understand that you don't want to alarm the public, but we're here to be partners to help problem solve this issue and come to some sort of acceptable understanding and agreement on what steps should be taken to mitigate these circumstances. So in the future, I just would hope that the Department of Health would be more upfront and more transparent with information. But again, Madam Chair, thank you so much for letting me come. I really appreciate it, and the committee for indulging and listening to me.
Well, I want to thank you for coming. The Senate last year took some leadership in dealing with these issues, and it's one of the reasons I felt very comfortable. We didn't have this discussion last year over here, so thank you. The next person I have is Representative Bunn, Benson, Stevenson, and Schumper. We're going to try to get to you all before we get to the end of this.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. First, I want to make just two quick comments, but welcome Director Stein to respond in clarification with those two comments. The first is that in terms of the mention during the discussion so far that we're talking the mention of waste sites or waste disposal 40s, 50s, 60s. My understanding is that most of these chemicals were not being disposed at that time. They're more recent chemicals, and in the last pertains to the last two decades, and then some of this waste production, waste disposal, was going on up till the late 90s and early 2000. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Bunn, actually, my understanding from our conversations with members of the staff at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and 3M is that they were manufacturing these compounds starting in the 1940s through the late 90s, so that there were waste products generated and likely disposed of through all those decades.
Good. Well, thank you for clarifying that it does go up to the late 90s, early 2000. That's when they discontinued production. So that relates to my next comment. Representative Moe and also Senator Swales raised a concern about the phrasing in the press release. You responded to the issue of, you know, the phrase, no immediate health risk. You responded to Representative Moe that what you do know about these types of compounds is that there's no acute risk, that it accumulates over time. Given that we only were able to measure these compounds in the last several years recently, and we have been disposing of them since the 1940s up till 2000, the acute exposure may well have already occurred. So your comments really pertain to if I, for the first time today, drank a glass of water from those wells, I wouldn't be at acute risk. But that doesn't say our citizens have not been at acute risk for some time because of long-term exposure and accumulation in their bodies. Is that a correct statement of that?
Madam Chair, Representative Bunn, yes. Anyone who's lived in the community, drank the water over decades, that it would depend upon their sources of water. One of the things that we do when we look at setting limits is try to identify, we're really focused on a person who's 100% of their source is that supply of water. So one of the things that when you consider our risk standards or the health-based values that we use, that's really set on the basis of a person who's drinking nothing else. Mm-hmm. Most people are not, but that is true that if a person were to drink that as their only water source, they would have had some effects of this compound being in their body for a longer period of time. We don't understand how that might affect them at this point.
Okay. Given that our residents may need to be concerned about some immediate risk to this because of accumulation over time. And I know that you referred to the possibility of developing community-wide or city-based waste filtering systems. We have recently done that in Bayport for TCEs, a different kind of pollutant, and you mentioned efforts in Oakdale to do that for these type of chemicals. Given that that process will naturally take a period of time to implement, and so we may have to go to individual household-based systems at least for a period of time, to your knowledge, are there currently any financial resources available to individuals in the community, to our citizens, to help them with the cost of filtration systems? Or might there be? Is it under discussion?
Madam Chair, Representative Bunn, mm-hmm. At this time we don't have a program in place for that. We're certainly open to that kind of a conversation. We could solicit ideas from other state agencies that may have programs that assist homeowners with various sorts of activities, but I'm not aware of any programs that currently exist to provide that level of assistance.
I imagine that's something we'll want to explore in the next few weeks or months as we go forward. Just two more, and I'll try to make some quick questions, Madam Chair, may I, about capacity and research going forward. You mentioned, I was pleased to hear the information about the dual testing, that you share samples so that there's some check on the testing. As previous representatives said, we have a very good relationship in our communities with 3M, and they've been very good citizens around even these water issues in the last many years. But I am concerned when you mentioned biomedical testing about the health effects, that both the study that was done this last fall and also the future testing that you mentioned, all that you mentioned was 3M-based research and effort on that. Obviously, while we have a lot of admiration for 3M's efforts, given they are the source as well for these pollutants, I would think we have to have third parties, whether it's you all or other research or research universities or other kinds of companies, mm-hmm. being doing this biomedical research as we go forward.
Madam Chair, Representative Bunn, yes, I can clarify that. That's a very good point. When 3M conducts research, they frequently contract with external partners. They can be research institutions of higher learning. They can be private firms. We have a very thorough evaluative process of any of those kinds of protocols for biomedical research or that type, toxicological research. And we do comment and contribute to the design of those research projects. So I think the integrity of the research and the work that's going on is very highly scrutinized. Mm-hmm. And I would say that the public's toxicologists have found 3M's work in that regard to be trustworthy. Mm-hmm. Some of the work is conducted by their offices, but the vast majority of it is contracted out to other parties. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think the credibility grows. In addition to that, I wanted to comment that 3M has conducted studies of their workers that have been exposed to these compounds through drinking water and through handling of the products and have not observed any quantifiable toxic effects in their workers. That's different levels of exposure to different, slightly different animal than what we're talking about, but I think it's worth noting that that's a relevant point of interest as we look at toxicity.
Final question?
I have a final question related to capacity, but if you would prefer, I defer to...
If you can make a chart.
Okay. Final question is in terms of going forward from this time. Do you have, in light of the recent developments or the ongoing developments in this area, and also general concern as we go into the future the relationship between environmental toxins and health effects, to expand your internal capacity in the department or other parts of state agencies to be able to do biomedical research linking environmental toxins to disease?
Mr. Stein.
Madam Chair and Representative Bunn, I'm not sure I understand. Do we have interest in exploring that, or I just want to be clear what you asked.
Well, you mentioned the types of research 3M's doing and some of it's farmed out. Do you have any interest or plans to develop some internal capacity to do your own work in that area or in other state agencies or in conjunction with the University of Minnesota or Rochester to develop this link between environmental toxins and health impacts?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Bunn. We have no current plan to expand our efforts into that area, but we would be very interested in talking about those ideas, mm-hmm. how that could be strengthened. I'm aware that Minnesota is viewed nationally as a leader in this regard because We have a very well informed public in this state, and we have some of the leading medical and chemical companies in the country here in Minnesota. And so we are positioned well to be answering a number of those questions. That being said, it's somewhat lonely to be on the front edge of this problem and to find other places in the country to give support and assistance has been very difficult. So we are looking for more and more creative ways to address that problem. We're very open to those conversations.
Thank you. President Bunn, I'm really glad that you asked that question, because I agree with you that we should be asking those kinds of questions. And I'm going to try to make sure that each of the next people get a chance to speak who haven't, Benson, Severson, and Trumper. And Mo, if we, Representative Mo, if we have time, we'll come back to you. I know you have your hands up. We may have to continue some of this next week. I do want to just put on the table one thing, though, that I know because of attending, being invited to attend some Senate hearings on this in the past, which is one of the reasons I was so open to having Senator Stephen here. I know that our laboratory at the Department of Health and the 3M laboratory are often in agreement. But I know that there have been studies it to a greater depth that have been conducted by our own MPCA with laboratories in Canada, for example, Access Laboratory, that uncovered PFCs to a level that our health department and our own MPCA did not uncover. So you need to answer that today, but I can just tell you I think the question about capacity is a very, very important one, and always lining up with the findings of the company that's producing the toxin is, which at least should raise some questions about third party testing that I think you raised. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did have a question, okay. But Representative Bunn asked
okay.
it, so thank
okay,
you.
Okay, respect that. Next is Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Stein, I just had a couple of questions. I'd like to get some clarification on this. This is the first I've heard about this issue, and I appreciate you bringing it forward. One of the things is, can you give us a picture of one part per billion? I mean, is that like one molecule in a glass of water, or can you give me some kind of volumetric measure on this?
Representative Severson, I strain against, my staff have told me don't go there, because that's a order of magnitude question that is challenging. But if you take one part per billion, one and is one item out of 1 billion items. Okay, so if you just think about that, most of us can't fathom an idea of what $1 billion is like, but $1 billion fills a fairly good sized chunk of a room. So that's the order, it's six orders of magnitude. It is, all that being said though, does not help clarify toxicity, and that's important to recognize it. Low levels, these are low levels, and the one thing I would say is if we were finding levels in the drinking water in Cottage Grove that were in order of magnitude, let's say 10 parts per billion or 100 parts per billion, we would obviously have much greater level of concern. But because we're in the 1 to 2, slightly over 2 in some of the community wells, parts per billion, We're at relatively low levels of these findings, and that does alleviate some of our concern over risk at this point.
And Madam Chair, follow.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the issues here, and as I've gone through this briefing and listened to the discussion, part of this thing, I think I may be wrong on this, but some clarification in that the PFOAs and PFOSs are the inherently longer in the system than the PFBAs. The PFOSs and the PFOAs have been tested for and have not been found in these particular areas. The PFBA that we're addressing in this issue is a new substance that you have found and feel that it's the obligation of the health department to come forward and say this is a new substance that we found in the water and that just a kind of a be alert. Is that correct, Director?
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Severson, yes, the PFOA and PFOS have had much more research in laboratory animals. They've been shown to have, those compounds have been shown to have toxic effects on liver functions and thyroid functions. There's much more research about that, basically laboratory animal studies. As I mentioned, there are very few studies that have been conducted. Only this one study has been conducted on PFBA, and we know very little about it. But they are all in the same family, cousins, if you will, of each other, of compounds. And in bringing this information forward at this time, it was our intent to make the public aware. Senator Stephen has left, but I did express this to her, that it was fully our intent to inform the legislative body and certainly local legislators when we had a sufficient amount of information to characterize the extent of this compound. At this point, we're still doing that, and so we'll have more to share with you as we learn more.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We're just about out of time. Representative Schumper, Representative Moore, if it can be short.
Yes, it can. Madam Chair, Mr. Stein, it really concerns me that you seem to, in your health advisory, came down on the side of ambiguity instead of on the side of caution. You've said many times here you don't know the health implications. You've only had one test. Why didn't you make a recommendation on bottled water? And can I ask also, why did you discuss your advisory with 3M prior to making it?
Mr. Rutstein.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, we did not discuss our advisory with 3M, other than to inform them that it was coming out.
Okay.
What we did is we believe that the level of one part per billion is a very cautious level. It's, at this point, it's unfair to characterize it as a similar number to a health-based value, where we've had more, in fact, generally to generate a health-based value or a health risk limit, you'd have to have a significant number of scientific studies in hand. So for us to call that level of concern equivalent is a challenge scientifically. Now, that creates the dilemma of communicating that risk to the public, and you're absolutely right that it could appear to a person reading this that we're not being cautious. In fact, we believe we are being very cautious by giving that information and helping people understand what we understand at this time.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Stein, you know, I'm a person with some scientific background, but when you talk about people should make their own determination as to whether they should be risk-averse or if they're risk-averse, I don't have any idea what that means, and I don't think most people do. Most people rely on experts such as yourself to kind of lead them through this technological society that we live in. And for just throw that out there and say, well, if you think you're risk adverse to this, go and buy some bottled water. That's incredibly ambiguous, I want to say. I would expect more than that from our Department of Health. Simple as that.
Madam Chair, if I could just respond quickly. I understand that, and I understand the confusion that working with science and human health creates. I will say that in terms of our response, I'm aware that other states don't have programs anywhere close to what we would have just been doing with these compounds. And so the fact that we're sharing information that's uncertain does create a problem in the community. And I appreciate that we're doing everything we can. We look for your advice to help. To help us understand how better to do that. But we are doing what we can to come forthright with the community and try to help them. And we will talk. We have been talking one-on-one with anyone who wants to, and we're going to be reaching out into the communities to try to provide information within the community to those individuals who may not have heard yet.
I appreciate that. Representative Moore, is your question very short? At committee, if you can bear with me just for a couple more minutes, if we have a short question.
I'll try to be brief, Madam Chair.
All right.
Mr. Stein, thank you again. You're on the hot seat for a long time here. My question is to enforcement authority of the Department of Health. As you know, in Cass Lake, Minnesota, there's a Superfund site where your recommendations are significantly lower than the EPA for exposure levels, yet the EPA is we can argue whether they're doing anything to enforce the higher standard, but they're adopting a far higher standard. What would your recommendations be for the legislature if we were to try to either enforce or give you the authority to enforce a more conservative, responsible standard for toxicity?
Mr. Stein?
Madam Chair, Representative Moll, that would take a long time to answer that question, but it's an interesting subject. We work providing advice about toxicity to risk managers and other agencies. In that case, let's talk about Cass Lake. Is it a federally governed response activity or is it a state governed response activity? That might get into Superfund law. That might get into other programs that are administered by MPCA or the Department of Agriculture. So we need to carefully look at all of those authorities. But in general terms, if there were interest in strengthening, so to speak, the state's ability to take enforcement action based on different numbers, you'd have to go in and adjust a number of state laws, I would think, to make that possible.
Madam Chair, I guess I'll let you go on that right now. I know we're running late. Perhaps we could talk privately. Could you give me some assistance on that?
Madam Chair, okay. Representative Moe, if I can bring along my pollution control agency and ag counterparts, we'd be happy to do that. Thank you.
And Representative Moe, I'm glad you had a chance to ask that question because one of the things we are going to do here, and this discussion I think just confirms it, and I appreciate your time and commitment to talking with us today, we are going to have two subcommittees, and one of them I can tell we do need to deal with this issue of environmental health, and we certainly will be very interested in working with the sister or brother agencies that are connected to that. So, committee members, I want to thank you for being here today. We have provided for the Department of Health two committee sessions, and I guess it turns out, fortunately, we didn't know that and we hadn't known about this press release, of course, until Friday. But we do have all of tomorrow, so we'll try to get through the rest of your budget tomorrow. And I do want to say that in the subcommittee, I think there will be plenty of time for this kind of discussion. And I encourage members who want to increase the capacity of our agencies to do what we need them to do to please think about legislation, and be glad to talk about it in this committee. And we'll deal with the rest of that tomorrow. Committee is adjourned.